My name is Sal Rosario from Princeton University. And I'd like to remind you of two things before I introduce our speakers. One of them is if you could lower the volume or silence your cell phones, that would be great. The other one is if you could complete the evaluation of the session at the end on the website or using one of those kiosk computers, they have links where you check your email. They have links right to the session evaluations. And that is really greatly appreciated here at EDUCAUSE. Let me introduce our two speakers. David Staley is the director of Harvey Goldberg Center for Excellence in Teaching and an adjunct associate professor in the Department of History at The Ohio State University. He's also a principal at D. Staley Group, a strategic foresight consulting firm. And if you read the Chronicle yesterday or today, you probably know him as the guy who doesn't know anything about higher education or Wikipedia. And if you haven't read the Chronicle, read it, especially the comments at the bottom. They're kind of interesting. Now, Dennis Trinkle serves as provost and chief academic officer for Harrison College. And he co-chairs the EDUCAUSE Constituent Group on Change Leadership. And he publishes and speaks widely on technology, teaching and learning, IT planning and management. And ladies and gentlemen, our speakers.
Well, thank you. Hopefully this will be an exciting and interactive session. Let me share two things with you. First, the session's actually not intended to be provocative. At least we're not deliberately trying to stir the pot. What we're trying to do is share a number of reflections on things about the landscape within which higher education works. Most of our points aren't explicitly about technology. They're about the ecosystem in which we're doing great things with technology and hopefully helping our institutions do great things with technology. So what we want to share is a variety of data points that help us recognize some key moments and trends that exist right now. Some of the data points may be provocative, but we're not presenting them intending to provoke, just sort of sharing an awareness of the landscape, and hopefully out of that be able to reflect a little bit on what do we do about this landscape, how exactly do we constructively plug into it, and what should we be thinking about it. So that's the setup, and hopefully the latter part will be a conversation as much as David and I just speaking with you. Second reflection that I want to share is that about 2 months ago I had the opportunity to speak with the Gentlemen's Club about the changing landscape of higher education. It was another just after lunch session, and I brought down the lights and showed the PowerPoint presentation. And by the end, I only had one gentleman in the audience who was still awake. Most of the room had sort of drifted gradually off to sleep, but I never got that one guy. Towards the end, I was thinking, you know, if I can just put him to sleep, I'll really have accomplished something. So I won't say that David and I explicitly have the goal to put you all to sleep, but if we put any of you to sleep, our goal will be to put all of you to sleep. So on that note, probably a good frame, Hamel had this in his general session as well, if you were able to attend that on Wednesday morning. The future is already here. The landscape trends are already here. They're just not very evenly distributed. So all of the points we want to talk about are characteristic either across higher education or at some place in higher education. We're just not all feeling them evenly and equally just yet. So I think that's an important thing to know off of the top. And I'm going to turn over to David at this point. We're going to go back and forth a little bit and try to antagonize each other as well and invite you to antagonize us. That part will be provocative.
Before I look at this first trend, Sal had mentioned that one of the things I do is strategic foresight consulting. In another language, that's sometimes called being a futurist, but I try to avoid using that term because it carries a lot of baggage to it. When you say futurist, they think, you know, you mean, you know, sort of junkets to Venus and, you know, we're gonna stop eating food and, you know, take pills and those sorts of things. But when I am working with clients and we're talking about future trends, one of the metaphors, one of the analogies I like to use comes from geology and talk about fault lines. That if we think of trends as being like fault lines and all of which, you know, being sort of in various stages of turning into earthquakes, I think that's a nice way of thinking about looking at trends. And each one of the dozen or so trends that we're looking at here, I think, we should think of as like fault lines. Some of them are already sort of blasting as Category 7 earthquakes, some of which I think are sort of tremors right now, but could very well become quite catastrophic earthquakes if we're not careful. I wish this were my analogy, that higher education looks like the restaurant market. It's not. It comes from Jim Burke. And what this means only is that higher education looks a lot like restaurants in the sense that there are a range of choices where you can go and have a good meal, right? So you can go to a five-star gourmet restaurant, or you can go to a fast food franchise, or you can go to a food vendor. Right? They're all various levels, all various ways of accessing food, I suppose. And in a sense, higher education really does, I think, look like this. We talk a lot about the system of higher education and whether you're for it or against it. We talk about the system of higher education. And I'm not certain we can really talk about higher education in America as being at least a monolithic system. It certainly is stratified. It certainly is segmented. And I think it's becoming increasingly segmented. And in fact, one of the trends that I'm watching is sort of the reversal of what Clark Kerr had said in the 60s about the creation of the multiversity. I think we could very well see the disaggregation of the multiversity and all the functions that we associate with multiversities breaking apart. So a center or an institution focused on research, one on teaching, one on outreach, the medical center, athletics, all as kinds of separate enterprises. We could see that kind of differentiation occurring. Do you buy that?
I do. So I just want to ask David, it sounds to me like you're saying that it's very difficult for us to compare a three-star Michelin restaurant with our local Applebee's, with our local environmentally friendly food restaurant.
Only in as much as that you can get food at each one of them, the quality of the food, the quality of the service, the experience, all those things would be quite different, so that I think you have to assess them differently.
So by extension then, when we try to talk about all universities as identical, we miss important measures of quality and outcomes and mission and how those all align.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Quite agree. Anything you want to add to that? Or?
Yep.
Maybe general education has never left the curriculum, but I hear it in advertisements in Columbus, not for Ohio State, but for some of the other universities in town, where they will differentiate themselves by saying, you don't have to take a lot of courses you don't need. And this is a selling point, right? I want to study X. Why do I have to study all these other things? I'll go to University Y because they don't make me take all these courses I don't really need. But and some of the consulting work I've done, especially with workforce development boards, I see the survey results from industry, from CEOs, from the corporate world. And again and again and again, the surveys say that what employers want are they want students with broad applicable skills, in a sense. They want students who have critical thinking skills and writing and speaking and arguing and researching and computing skills. They want students who have broad cultural and global understandings. In other words, the sorts of things that we think about as being part of general education. But the survey suggests that this is through a focus on teaching skills and not necessarily content. And so one of the trends we're sort of following is this return of general education to the curriculum, and that general education is transforming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What I would add to that is I think we all need to be paying attention and to be very attuned to how, in very interesting ways, community colleges, vocational schools, trade schools, for-profit institutions are starting to take very seriously the notion of general education. They're hearing strongly from employers that it's not sufficient that students go out into the world equipped with X, Y, or Z technical skill, but that they absolutely have to be equipped with the ability to reason critically, to think innovatively, to adjust on the job. And they're taking that charge significantly and seriously in their curriculum and putting in very strong general education requirements to be able to do that. And so thinking about there being some sectors of education that don't take general education seriously and others that take it very, very seriously is starting to look a bit like a cliche.
I think this has implications for what I'll call middle skill level jobs, and we'll talk a little bit more here about what middle skill level means.
This is an two interesting data points, and I will read them, but I think reading them and reflecting on them, think about them from the all of the implications for your universities, how you structure technology, accessibility, the services you provide, the different communities you have. We continue to think about the traditional face of the faculty as tenured and tenure track, and the reality is, taking all sectors of higher education today, more than 70% of faculty members in all aggregate higher education institutions are now adjuncts and part-timers. The tenure track cohort is now the minority. And it is also true that a lot of recent polling done by parents and by current students suggests that they're not willing to pay more to have tenure track faculty. They don't see an inherent value in having tenure or tenure track faculty. They certainly do in professional expertise. They're not conflating or equating the two, and not intending to provoke, just sharing the data. Important to realize how very different than maybe our reflex is, the landscape actually is.
Part of the next phase of the globalization of higher education, people wiser than I have observed that the higher education landscape today looks in some ways like the medieval system, in that there was a lot of student mobility across Europe to the great centers of learning. And that something similar seems to be occurring as well on a global scale today. More and more students, we think of international students coming to the United States, right? We've always sort of cornered that market. If you're an international student, where else are you going to go but the United States? Well, there's all sorts of evidence that suggests that China is emerging as an important destination for students. And, of course, if we read the Chronicle, we know that China and Saudi Arabia and Singapore are spending large amounts of capital to build their own top-tier universities, and they're looking very much to compete with American institutions of higher education. So it's students that are the mobile source right now.
Yep, that interesting reflect – well, I'll come back to that.
Sorry. Yeah, you want to? Okay. Well, yes. This is where you want to reflect on that. Great.
That is where we're. Yep. Exactly. So, in addition to students and students becoming more global and having different patterns of transition, another trend that one can observe that we should be thinking about rather significantly is the fact that many multinational corporations, both in the United States and elsewhere, are accelerating their move to starting their own universities, not just corporate internal universities, but starting their own internal universities. And they're saying not just about the American higher education system, but higher education systems as they've existed in global contexts are insufficient to their needs. So whether you're looking at institutions like Steelcase in the United States or Indian multinational companies, they're opening these large multi-thousand student campuses to provide training because of the perception that we are no longer adequately preparing students for their workforces. That's a really interesting data point.
Another similar sort of trend that I'm seeing is just the notion of non-traditional players in our market. The Center of Science and Industry in Columbus is I guess it was voted the top science center in the country. They have their own sort of internal training. They call it COSI-U. And I was having some conversations with those folks, and I said, so when are you going to make a real COSI-U? And there was silence in the room. This is something they weren't going to admit to, but it was very clear this is something they're thinking about. So museums, for instance, getting into the business of education, and not just educating school kids, but getting into the business of higher education.
Is there anybody in the audience from Pearson? Have had interesting conversations with reps from Pearson recently. Pearson actually got to the point where they have been progressively working towards building on the top of their curricular web support modules, and got very far along then from building web support modules to building student analytic tools and instructional facilitation tools, and they almost launched their own university. They backed away from it because of focus group feedback. My understanding is they backed away from it because of focus group feedback from higher ed institutions that they wouldn't buy textbooks from somebody competing directly against them. So they backed away from it. But they were right at the precipice of launching their own higher educational institution, which is not to say anything negative about Pearson, but just to highlight that there are many organizations from a lot of different vantage points out there contemplating doing exactly that.
Mm-hmm. If you were involved in the presentation that I did with a couple of colleagues yesterday, one of the first things I mentioned about the Agile University was the idea of the new invisible college that's emerged in the sciences. This is the observations of Caroline Wagner, who's written a book called The New Invisible College. But I find this particularly interesting because what we're seeing is, at least in the sciences, greater collaboration across boundaries facilitated by technology. But the idea is that we're talking about new structures of knowledge, networks, global networks, outside of departments, tied to individual universities, certainly outside of the national big science model that's dominated since the end of the Second World War. We're talking about international networks that are just as important, maybe even more important, to individual faculty members than ties to their local universities. And this isn't just simply keeping up email correspondences. This is carrying out, conducting scientific work over networks that in some ways could sort of challenge the way we tend to think about the organization and management of knowledge. We tend to assume that's sort of associated by in universities. We could see these global networks, I think, posing a pretty significant challenge. Don't add to that.
Well said.
Okay.
So non-traditional students are now traditional students. In a lot of ways, we continue to talk about traditional. And one thing to frame and sort of try to add additional gravity to is the very real degree to which what used to be traditional is now non-traditional, and what used to be non-traditional is now traditional, maybe being a little bit too clever. But if you look at all sectors of higher education, so aggregate everybody who's in a college or university of any kind, it is now the case that the majority of students are now over the age of 25, and more than 60% of those students are working full time while they're pursuing their studies.
It'd be like saying, it'd be like calling zoology the study of non-elephant animals. Right. It just doesn't make any sense. And I think increasingly that term non-traditional is starting to lose its meaning in the current landscape. Right now, I think the for-profits are under the gun. If you've been reading the Chronicle, if you've just been following the news, you know the kind of pressures that the for-profits are feeling, especially with the whole gainful employment concern. I think that once this political pressure dies down for the for-profits, those of us in the non-profit educational sector are next. They're going to be looking at us with the same kind of critical lens, I think, and that they, you know, however you want to define it, policymakers, the government agencies. Sorry? Yes. Yes. And policymakers. Yes.
I'll take this one away.
Okay. Well, because we only have 50 minutes. That's the only reason I'm hesitating. But
so the quick answer I'll give you is essentially right. All politics comes down to the allocation of scarce resources. It's just a math problem. And if you look at the budget structure that we as a country have with and the percentage of allocation that's going to be devoted to debt service and entitlements out over the next 30 years, there are just declining resources, drastically declining resources. And so the battles over what value your tax dollar investment has are only going to get more and more fierce. So I think every dollar that's invested in anything from the government side is going to be scrutinized, and higher education is under that lens for a couple of unique moment after the Second World War in a lot of ways. So during a unique moment of a few decades, higher education got a lot of positive passes in terms of the value estimation, and now you're seeing just a much higher scrutiny from the government side, and on the other side, just a much stronger consumer mentality, right?
Yes.
We're consumers. We're not just seeking to be participating in something that does X, Y, and Z, but we're buying this service, and because we're buying this service, we demand that it have X, Y, and Z value. So squeeze from both sides, both sides of which really come down to math.
This generation, especially the traditional students and their parents, really do see higher education as an investment in an economic future, and they want to see returns on investment on that education. And so the idea of going to college, to better yourself, to become a better citizen, that's the sort of the pushback that we're starting to see. What we were seeing this summer with the for profits was if these students are going to take government student loans and they're not going to get the kinds of jobs that are going to allow them to repay those student loans, well, someone has to be held to account. And right now the for-profits are feeling that sting. I think the not-for-profits are next. They're going to be asking us the same questions. If students are going to take out loans, enormous loans, if they're going to be paying, you know, upwards of, you know, $100,000 or so for their educations, what are they getting for it in return? And so that's what I mean by the pressure to demonstrate the value added as an economic proposition, the value added of a college degree. In many ways, that's tied to the next one. Do you have anything you wanted to add to this? Or? Closely allied, I couldn't decide if this was a separate slide, and I decided to make it a separate slide. I think the perception of the value of a college education is also changing. Right now, part of the general discussion that we're seeing across the country is whether or not a degree truly is a ticket into the middle class, which has been the assumption since the end of the Second World War. And in some ways, we could see this as a function of the Great Recession and the high unemployment that caused. But I think it's also evidence of a longer-term trend, where the value of a college degree in being that automatic ticket to the middle class maybe isn't there. Maybe what we'll see is an increasing interest in certificates. Stackable certificates are sometimes called. Maybe we're going to see something like just-in-time training over a lifetime. Right now, our relationship with alumni is you've got your degree, out the door you go, and by the way, we'll be contacting you next if you want football tickets or if you want to give us money. And I think one of the things we'll see is a changing relationship with our alums. You're not just simply out the door. You are still part of this institution. And one of the suggestions I've heard is you pay tuition. That gives you a certain freedom, I suppose, or it gives you tuition discounts if you wanted to come back later for some continuing professional development. Say you go to your alma mater for that continuing professional development, or maybe you want to do a second career, or maybe you reach retirement age and you want to take that humanities course that you didn't think was valuable when you were 18 or 19 years old. But it strikes me that there'll be new kinds of relationships we'll have with our alumni.
Yeah, interesting. So I'm going to comment on this, but first I'm going to pick on David just by way of making the point again about traditional and non-traditional. Really easy to characterize conversations in the context of alumni when, back to the data point, the majority of students are actually in educational experiences now that do not establish for them a sense of community or connection to a university. So the stable attraction notion of alumni is actually a bit anachronistic for the majority of students. It's certainly deeply meaningful for many of your institutions and for much of higher education. But if you're talking about aggregate numbers of students, the whole concept of alumni and alumni adherence is now pretty alien. So there's that danger in thinking about the non-traditional today in the traditional terms of tomorrow. In terms of the perception of the value of a college education, this is a difficult one to just talk about as a data point, so do my best just to reflect on this one objectively just from the data point and say, if you've read the Chronicle or the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, certainly the issue of cost and access is driving lots of conversations about the value proposition. I think the debate of whether or not a college degree is worthwhile really does come back to the how much, at what point is it worthwhile? To what extent should you be paying for it? Certainly the data about what it means for one's future is abundantly clear that getting at least some degree of college education is essential. A recent study came out that said there are really only three things that you need to do in this country to have a virtual guaranteed ticket into the middle class. Virtual guaranteed ticket. Now, the absence of them is a good social reflection for you. But to be middle class in America, three simple things that you do in 90% certainty you're going to wind up being middle class. One is graduate from high school. Two is get some degree of college education, associate's degree or higher. And the third is be married before you conceive a child. It doesn't matter what age you are when you conceive the child. But those three simple things, 90% certain you're going to be middle class in America. So college education in there certainly matters. Other things matters as well.
I hadn't heard that data point before. Doing the checklist in my head. I'd mentioned you can still make it, Dave. I'd mentioned middle skill level jobs earlier, and I wanted to expand on what I meant by that. Middle skill is a term that comes from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and one of the trends that they're following is that as baby boomers retire, there's going to be quite a surge in demand for middle skill level positions, which the Bureau describes as those occupations that require more than a high school degree but less than a full four-year degree. So think of it in terms of either certificates or associate's degrees, or maybe it's apprenticeship in some sort of trade. And the sorts of jobs we're talking about here are like the skilled trades, for instance. So, you know, carpenters and plumbers and electricians, those sorts of jobs, backhoe operators. I do some consulting in the engineering and commercial construction industry, and this is something they're very, very concerned about. The sorts of people who are engaged in these trades are people in their 50s and early 60s, and they're not seeing the number of young people who are interested in these sorts of jobs yet. We're starting to see an uptick again, though, an interest in the trades, in building, in fixing things, in making things. The value of the skilled trades is rising. It's still significantly less, I think, but it's rising relative to that of symbolic work. And we could increasingly see more students that say, you know, I don't want to be an accountant to be in a cube farm someplace. I want to, you know, become a carpenter and become my own boss. And that there's value in that kind of work, and that I can have a good middle-class life doing those kinds of hard jobs, the sorts of things that Mike Rowe likes to show on his show. Nothing you want to add? Or? In a sense, I've already discussed this when we talk about alums or whatever term Dennis wants to use to describe them. But in some ways, many universities are transforming into networks of relationships and not just simply sites for knowledge and information, especially when there's a perception, right or wrong, that information and knowledge can come from other sources outside of traditional academic settings. One of the things that we'll see is that universities act as these professional relationships. And I know Harrison is thinking along some of those lines, right?
Absolutely true. Mm-hmm. Absolutely true. So on this point, interesting, I think you can think about traditional higher education as facing innovation from two sides. On the one side, certainly openness and open projects, the freelance university, Wikiversity, the underground university, all of those projects trying to undercut what traditional universities have done or redefine the traditional higher education landscape by proposing new models, doing it in socially collaborative kinds of ways, agile university kinds of ways, and so forth. On the other hand, you have the for-profits trying to be very niche and specific and driving on segments and being very responsive to student and community needs, all putting a transformational squeeze on middle models that have been around for a longer period of time.
Someone asked me sort of a what-if thought experiment, and given what happened to Chronicle, I guess I have to be very careful about asking what-if questions, but I'm going to ask a what-if question. What if state universities decided to go private, especially as state funding decreases? We're certainly seeing that here in California. We haven't felt it yet in Ohio. I suspect we might the next budget cycle. But as that public funding decreases, will these public universities, in a sense, go private? I understand there are all sorts of difficulties with that, but as a what-if exercise, I think it's an important one to consider. I think one of the implications is that it sort of views higher education more as a private rather than a public good. And I think certainly since the end of the Second World War, we've seen higher education certainly as a public good. And increasingly, I think we're seeing it more and more defined in terms of a private investment in one's personal future.
Yeah, absolutely intending to leave all of these points in the lands of what are the implications and not drive to any specific conclusions. But related theme was having a conversation yesterday with someone at the flagship state university from a western state who was sharing that they are really struggling, provost and president racking their heads to figure out how to adjust their business model because of the unintended consequence of the great success of the community college system, seeing exactly what we all talked about as a potential challenge, losing the first 2 years of the program where you pay for most of the upper division courses. Surprise, surprise, it's coming to pass right at a time of squeezed revenue, and now the expectation that the state would be able to somehow fund out of that crisis isn't materializing, and big state flagship university is trying to figure out what to do about it. A very closely related phenomena. So what are the implications? At this point, we want to reflect some with you and absolutely invite it to be a dialogue. When you talk about provocative data points that have to do with the landscape, it never seems sufficient to me, and I know to David as well, to just hang them out there and leave everybody to go off and have a little bit of indigestion right after lunch thinking, wow, that's all challenging. What the heck do we do about it? So we want to talk a little bit about constructively how you frame it. Both David and I are historians, and I used to teach courses on the Industrial Revolution, and in teaching the Industrial Revolution, I always said, you know, the Luddites get a really bad rap. The Luddites weren't wrong at all. They were clear-sighted realists who understood exactly what was happening in the world around them. They loved a particular way of life. They valued a particular way of life, and they saw that way of life being wiped out, and they pushed back to defend a way of life. So it's not that they were just idiotic fools opposed to technology. They were passionate defenders of a particular lifestyle in a particular moment of history. Ultimately, they didn't prevail, and historians get to write history in different ways. But I think whenever we look at these data points, it's really important to take all of those kinds of points very, very seriously. It's not that their discussions are bad or good, or that those who passionately argue, hey, some of these trends are awful and we ought to hold on tooth and nail to things that are clearly under assault in those data points. Those are all perfectly right, rational postures. The point is to understand what the landscape really looks like and then to be able to self-reflectively engage appropriately in it. So that's the intent of the slides and the hope of the conversation. I thought I would start with a couple of reflections just in terms of individual posture. Yeah, please. Go ahead.
I thought one of the smartest things, honestly, that was a brilliant idea.
Could everyone hear that? Okay. So we don't have to repeat the question. At Ohio State, in the history department, where I come from, this is a model we're experimenting with. We're creating an alumni society for history alums, and it's special programs just for them. It's, you know, lectures. It's our department faculty giving special lectures, special events. Right now, we're trying to work on a no-cost model, or at least a membership sort of model. But the whole point of this is not—it's not an ask, right? It's not—you know—at the end of the lecture, we're going to say, "And now, dear alums, you know, please open up your checkbook so you can support the Department of History." This is part of the relationship building that we're trying to do with our alumni. So we're putting—I'd like to think—we're putting our money where our mouth is. Thank you.
So one of the slides we opened with was that university is like a restaurant. The same is true for the solution set, right? However we respond to these challenges, however we frame them, it's not going to be the case that there is one answer. Michelin three-star restaurants aren't going to be the only way to go. There's going to be a variety of responses that plug in from different niche points in the kind of institutions we want to affiliate with. So I think that's the starting point. Was reflecting with somebody from EDUCAUSE yesterday on Hamill's talk. And what do you actually do with Hamill's talk? Where do you go with Hamill's talk? Same sort of question with these trends. Exactly where do you go with them? The first question has to come from a moment of introspection from individuals in the room, right? We love our institutions, but the first thing that we have to decide is what do we think of ourselves and our identity? How do we want to engage? Do we love our institution and what it represents, and we want to engage in some way to strengthen it and make it as strong as possible it can, to continue to make it relevant, to help it adapt and change, put our energies into directing our institution into that path? Or are we a restless innovator? Don't feel like we can accomplish what we want to accomplish strictly within the confines of our institutions, and need to seek paths to be able to embrace all of the opportunities that are inherent in moments of disruptive change. And that can happen in two ways. Some folks leave their institutions and go out and work for different kinds of institutions, startups, whether they're for-profit or non-profit. Other folks take hybrid paths. David really is a model, I think, for higher education in terms of being able to have a very traditional career in a very stable, traditional kind of university. And by some measures, breaking my own rule and using traditional, while at the same time free-ranging in the DeSantis Daily Group and driving lots of provocative ideas to change the landscape and helping to found new technologies and new visualization approaches, indeed entirely new disciplines and ways of knowing. And so David has proven that you can do it in an institution while also working simultaneously outside of the institution. Sometimes leaving the institution and helping find new kinds of institutions is the answer, and sometimes just staying in and helping your institution to stay relevant and evolve is the right course. So I think the first thing that I would suggest for folks wondering, where do I really go in confronting these data points, would be to think a little bit about where you want to go. What kind of posture do you want to adapt in this kind of disruptive environment? And invite comments, thoughts, riffs along those lines. Please. Do you want to, so I guess my reflection would be interesting point. I think that's a different reading of the quotation than I had taken out of it. I took out of it just the holding up the great diversity in types of institutions, maybe a grocery store more than a restaurant. But what you're suggesting is that not only should there be great diversity, but there ought to be interoperability where the different kinds of restaurants respect each other and share their ingredients and so forth across their various boundaries. That's a really interesting point, Tom.
There's some Michelin restaurants I can't get a reservation. When I'm consulting with clients and I present them with a number of trends, one of the exercises that we do is to say, all right, here's the trend. What are you going to do about it? And what that means is doing sort of a business capacity exercise. And so I ask, clients, how can you leverage this? All right, here's the reality. What can we do to leverage it? And I'm wondering if you have any reaction to any of the trends we've listed here. Are there ways that we can respond to these trends from wherever we may come in the higher education landscape? Any thoughts on that, please?
I was reading an article.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting. It makes me completely agree with that, and it makes me think of a principle in instructional design, the good enough is good enough principle, right? Instructional designers, usability experts have done a variety of studies to find out at which point do you overproduce, you put too much into production, you put so much into production values that it actually has no really significant additional impact on learning outcomes. When do you know it's good enough? And I mean, what a lot of research has found is it's actually a pretty low level of media sophistication. To have a pretty high level of learning outcomes sophistication. And then above that, when you start to get into Pixar land or Disneyland, since it's next door, it's a lot prettier, and it has tiny marginal impacts on outcomes, but not really significant additional impacts on outcomes. Is Pixar better in a qualitative sense? Absolutely. Is it better in a quantitative way? Well, then you get into a values question.
I want to take a slightly different tack, and at the risk of being chastised by Dennis by talking about traditional students. When I'm giving presentations like this to businesses and talking about higher education, I like to point out the 80s sitcom Family Ties. Do you remember Family Ties? I'm showing my age, I know. But remember, the situation was the parents were ex-aging hippies, right? And they, you know, were concerned with a meaningful life, right? Living life to the fullest, and saw education in very much the same way. Go to university to find yourself. And of course, one of their children was Alex P. Keaton, right? The young Republican, the Reagan Republican, who was only interested in making a lot of money. Alex P. Keaton is the father of our 18 and 19-year-old students.
Well, now I won't sleep tonight.
Okay. And so very different expectations about what higher education means. Yeah. So Alex P. Keaton. You heard it here first. Please.
For institutions that are also research institutions, do you see that as a variable?
I do, yes. And that was part of the disaggregation I mentioned in the beginning. I could see, in a sense, the research function being sort of in some ways, it's already been sort of spun off, but spun off as a separate kind of enterprise. I see that with athletics too. I could very easily see that scenario occurring. You know, we have a program at Ohio State that's essentially, you know, it's for all intents and purposes a semi-professional organization. So I could see that kind of disaggregation of the research function, say, away from the teaching function. So Harvard University and Harvard College. Just an example off the top of my head.
Yeah, I'd be interested in reflections back. My sense is you never get across the pond in one big step. Mm-hmm. You do it in little steps, lily pad to lily pad.
Right.
And I wonder if the first steps across that disaggregation pond haven't been taken. Doesn't mean you'll also go straight across the pond. Could take lots of forks from here. But The way I interpret the landscape is that much of the research function has now been redefined as economic development.
Right.
And when it's invested in by the state, it's no longer on the basis of pure research or pure pursuit of knowledge. I mean, it might be for certain rhetorical posturings, but largely the investment's coming on the basis of economic development, and that's being increasingly valued, but that's a very different thing to value than research in its prior guise.
As someone that comes from a humanities department, this is a conversation I try to have with colleagues about when we say research and when the state or other entities say research coming out of universities, they mean very different things. And so I wonder about the research mission coming from the humanities and the soft social sciences, for instance. Are we going to be either forced or, you know, drag kicking and screaming to this sort of model that Dennis just described? Tech transfer for the humanities. That's going to keep me up at night. So,
funding is supporting research. Private funding will be supporting education.
Or teaching and learning, yes.
Yeah. I don't think that. So it varies based on locality, but I think there's some truth to that.
I do, too.
I think it's actually – I worked as a lobbyist for a couple of years not too long ago and can – definitely tell you from the State House perspective that it is easy to get the legislature to agree to invest in economic development than it is to get it to invest in higher education.
And, of course, that those funds for research don't necessarily have to come from state entities. It can come from venture capital, and we certainly see that with tech incubator projects that surround universities. Again, an idea for the humanities. We still have a few more minutes. Yes, please.
My blood pressure just went up 20 degrees. Thank you. Yeah, I think that's a
good.
Critical issue. That's one of the constraints for institutions trying to transform themselves to respond to market trends, right? I mean, or to the changing landscape, or however you want to drive it. I think what we're going to see is lots of additional modes of education, different ways of valuing, popping up because of the friction or the irrational constraints imposed by certain things inherent in the accreditation process. I think the accreditation process will ultimately respond, but I don't think it's going to happen very quickly. So I think it will push an awful lot of the innovation out to the margins because it has to happen, right? The needs are there. The employers need it. Students want X, Y, and Z. Educational paths, lifestyles are conducive to certain things happening. It just has to happen. And if it can't happen down the traditional highway, then just like the cow paths that eventually get paved over, back to the Agile University presentation, people are going to go where they're going to go. So I think we'll find lots of ways to work around that in a regulatory context, and accreditation will respond. That's like an hour-long conversation, but love to hear other thoughts as well.
I think we can take one more. Is that true, Sal? We can take one more.
Yep, would agree. My historian brain will just respond and say that the point to which we point back and describe it as traditional always varies over time and adjusts over time, right? Otherwise, we'd go back to the advent of college and universities and the liberal arts, at which point we're really talking about affluent gentlemen who were seeking the knowledge that would allow them to engage as gentlemen. And the quadrivium and the trivium were part of that, but it was always about professional advancement among an elite, and that would be our reference point. But it's shifted a lot over the centuries.
Thank you. Sal, is there anything you need to say? Or? We can take one more? We can take one more, apparently. Or would you rather digest or get indigestion or... Mergers and acquisitions. Is there much to be said for mergers and acquisitions in education? You mean, is it coming? Is it a good thing? Is it?
Yeah, you see it. You know, we talk about scarcity of resources.
Yeah. I try to avoid to talk about inevitability, but I could see it as a very high probability that we could see that. In fact, it was Dana College in Nebraska, and I forgot the name of the other institution, but essentially those two small colleges merged. I think especially for the small liberal arts colleges, I could very, very clearly see that happening. Ohio is scattered with such colleges, and I could very easily see them merging together as a way to leverage costs. Can you envision that term?
I can certainly envision it. I think we'll absolutely see it. I won't make a blanket statement that it makes sense, because I think all those kinds of things are contextual. In some places, it will absolutely make sense. Where does it make sense? Whatever the institutional missions are, if it's teaching undergrads 18 to 22 or teaching adult learners or pursuing basic research or pursuing applied research, whatever the mission is, if you can take two B institutions, pull them together and create an A effort against mission, that's when you do it. Or if you can take two A institutions and make them world-class innovative institutions against mission by pulling them together, it absolutely makes sense. There are lots of bad reasons for mergers and acquisitions, and 75% of them fail in both effective and economic terms. So, I mean, they're not a panacea, but when they work, they work. Thank you. Hey, find us in the hallway. We're both really wound up about all these topics, and we'd love to talk with you.
And we hope we were provocative. Thank you.